For water and earth and fire are themselves voiceless, but all of them give sound when breath falls upon them and produce noises and crashes, whereas bronze has no share of void at all, but being blended with uniform and smooth breath, is readily struck and resonant. And if one must judge by sight, iron appears to have more of what is porous and full of void and honeycomb-like. Yet it is exceedingly harsh-sounding and the most mute of the metals. There was, then, no need to trouble the night by contracting its. There was no need to cause trouble for the night by contracting and stretching taut its air, and elsewhere again leaving spaces and voids, as though the air were an obstacle to sound and were destroying the very substance of which it is itself, the substance, body, and power. Without such devices, irregular nights, misty and stormy ones, would surely have to be more resonant than clear, evenly mixed nights, on the theory that atoms are pushed together in one place, while the place they leave behind is left empty of bodies. And most obviously of all, a cold day would have to be more resonant than a warm summer night. Neither of these is true. So, having abandoned this explanation, I turn instead to Anaxagoras, who says that the air is set in motion by the sun with a trembling motion full of pulsations, as is evident from the tiny specks and fragments that constantly flit through a beam of light, which some call motes. These particles, he says, hiss and crackle in response to the heat during the day, and by their noise make speech hard to hear, whereas at night their agitation and sound become manifest. When I had said this, Ammonius said, "Perhaps we shall look ridiculous, imagining we are refuting Democritus and correcting Anaxagoras. Still, the hissing must be removed from Anaxagoras' particles. It is neither plausible nor necessary. The trembling of the particles and their motion as they are agitated in the light are enough by themselves, often, to tear voices apart and scatter them. For the air, as has been said, is the body of voice, and by furnishing itself as substance, when it is stable it transmits the parts and movements of sounds far off, in a straight, smooth, and continuous line. Calm and stillness are resonant, and the opposite holds too, as Simonides says, nor did any leaf-shaking blast of winds then arise, which might have hindered the honey-sweet voice, as it spread, from reaching the ears of mortals. Often the agitation of the air does not even let the articulate shape of speech reach our perception fully formed, yet it always carries something of its volume and magnitude. Night itself, then, by itself has nothing that sets the air in motion, but day has a great one, the sun, as Anaxagoras himself said. Thrasyllus, Ammonius' son, took this up and said, "Then what has come over us in God's name that we think we must appeal to theoretical motions of the air while overlooking its plain, visible turbulence and violence? For that great ruler in heaven, the sun, our Zeus, does not creep up unnoticed or gently stir the smallest particles of air. The moment he appears, he raises up and sets everything in motion, giving favorable signs, rousing peoples to their work. And they follow, as though reborn, thinking new thoughts with each day, as Democritus says, with activities neither silent nor idle." Ibicus was not wrong to call dawn famed, since it is then that both hearing and speaking already occur. But at night, the air being for the most part waveless and unheard, since everything is at rest, it naturally sends the voice up to us unbroken and whole. Aristodemus of Cyprus, who was present, said, "But watch out, Thrasyllus, that this is not disproved by the night battles and night marches of great armies, which make voices carry no less far, even though the air is in turmoil and agitation. There is also a cause on our own side. What we ourselves say at night is for the most part urgent, rousing someone with pressing emotion or making inquiries, so that we make our calls strained and forceful. Whatever rouses us to action and speech at just the time we are naturally disposed to keep still is no small or gentle thing, but something great, driven by the compulsion of some pressing need, so that our voices too are carried more forcefully." When the Isthmian Games were held, in the second term of Sospi's presidency of the Games, we managed to avoid his other banquets, at which he entertained many guests at once, and often all the citizens together. But on one occasion, when he received his closest friends and men of letters at his home, we too were present. When the first tables had been cleared, someone came bringing Herod's the orator a palm branch and a woven crown, sent by an acquaintance who had won a prize for a speech of praise. Herod's accepted these graciously and sent them back, saying he was puzzled why the different contests each have their own crown, while the palm belongs to all of them alike. I, for one, he said, am not persuaded by those who point to the equality of its leaves, rising up opposite each other and growing out together, as it were, and claim this resembles a contest and rivalry, and that the very word victory, nike, derives from not yielding, me iken. For a great many other plants, too, distribute nourishment to their paired leaves with what amounts to exact measure and weight, producing a marvelous equality and order. Still less convincing are those who suppose the ancients loved the palm for its beauty and fine growth, inferring this from Homer, who compared the bloom of the Phaeacian girl to a young shoot of a palm. You surely are not unaware that people also pelted victors with roses and campions, and some even with apples and pomegranates, as beautiful things, always honoring their champions this way. But the palm has nothing so conspicuously superior to other plants, since in Greece it does not even bear edible fruit, only fruit that is unripe and unfit to eat. If, as in Syria and Egypt, it produced its date, most delightful of all things to look at, and in sweetness to eat as a dessert, nothing else could be compared to it. The king, they say, being especially fond of the peripatetic philosopher Nicolaus, who was sweet in character, slender and tall, and full in the face with a ruddy blush, used to call the largest and finest dates Nicolauses, and to this day they are still called that. In saying this, Herod seemed to have brought in the story about Nicolaus no less pleasantly than the question itself. All the more reason, then, said Sospes, for each of us to be eager, as far as each is able, to contribute something to the question. I offer mine first. The reputation of victors ought to remain, as far as possible, unfading and ageless, and the palm is among the longest-lived of plants, as the Orphic verses 2 attest somewhere, a creature living as long as the crown-topped shoots of palms. And it is almost alone in truly possessing what is falsely claimed of many other plants. What is that? To keep its leaves steadfastly, to be truly evergreen. For neither the laurel, nor the olive, nor the myrtle, nor anything else said not to shed its leaves, do we ever see keeping the very same leaves forever. Rather, as the first ones fall away, others grow in their place, and like a city, each remains ever living and undiminished only as a whole. But the palm, casting off none of what grows on it, is truly and constantly evergreen, and it is precisely this strength of it that people especially associate with the might of victory. When Sospes had finished, Protogenes the grammarian, addressing Praxiteles the guide by name, said, "Shall we simply let these orators go on arguing their own way, from probabilities and plausibilities, while we ourselves contribute nothing from history? And yet I believe I recall, having read it recently in the Attic histories, that Theseus was the first to hold a contest on Delos, and that he tore off a branch of the sacred palm, which was then called a spadix." Praxiteles replied, "This is uncertain, and people will say we should ask Theseus himself why, when he presided over the contest, he tore a branch from the palm rather than from laurel or olive. Consider instead whether the prize of victory is really Pythian, instituted by Amphictyon. For their two victors were first adorned, in honor of the god, with laurel and palm, since people dedicate to the god not laurels or olives but palms, as Nicias did on Delos when serving as Corgos for the Athenians, and as the Athenians did at Delphi, and, earlier still, Cypselus the Corinthian. For our god, besides, is a lover of contests and of victory, competing himself in lyre playing, song, and discus throwing, and, as some say, even in boxing, and lending aid to men who compete, as Homer testifies, portraying Achilles saying, 'We bid these two men, being the best, to raise their fists and box hard for this prize, and to whichever Apollo grants the endurance to win.' And of the archers, the one who prayed to the god hit the mark and took first prize, while the other, too proud to pray, missed the target. Nor, indeed, is it likely that the Athenians dedicated their gymnasium to Apollo without reason, by mere chance. Rather, they believed that the god from whom we have our health also gives good condition and strength for contests. And since there are light and heavy events, it is recorded that the Delphians sacrifice to Apollo as a boxer, and the Cretans and Lacedaemonians as a runner. And do not the dedications of spoils, first fruits of victory, and trophies at Delphi likewise, testify that this god has the greatest share in the power to win and to prevail?" While he was still speaking, Cephisus, son of Theon, broke in and said, But none of this smells of history or of guidebooks at all. It has been dragged up from the very heart of peripatetic commonplaces and argued merely for plausibility. What's more, my friends, by hoisting up the god like a piece of stage machinery, in tragic fashion, you are simply trying to frighten off anyone who disagrees. The god, as is fitting, is equally well disposed to everyone. Let us instead, following Sospes, for he leads us well, return again to the palm, since it offers our discussion plenty of handholds. The Babylonians hymn and sing of it as providing them 360 kinds of uses. For us Greeks, it is scarcely useful at all, and this very fruitlessness might belong to an athletic ideal. Being the most beautiful and the largest of trees, it is, through its own good discipline, unfruitful among us. Just as an athlete's regimen consumes his nourishment on his body, so only a small and poor amount is left over for the palm to put into seed. But beyond all this, it has a peculiar property, shared by no other tree, which I am about to mention. If you lay weights on top of a palmwood beam and press down on it, it does not yield by bending downward, but curves the other way, as though resisting the force applied to it. The very same thing happens in athletic contests. Those who give in to their trials through weakness and softness are pressed down and bent by them, while those who vigorously endure their training are raised up and grow, not only in body, but in spirit as well. Someone raised the question why ship captains draw their water from the Nile at night rather than by day. To some, it seemed that they feared the sun, since it preheats liquids and makes them more prone to spoil. Everything that has been heated or warmed is always more ready to change, having already, through the loosening of its quality, been made susceptible. Cold, by contrast, by compressing things, seems to hold each thing together and preserve it in its natural state. Water not least of all, since coldness is a property naturally proper to water, as snow shows, keeping meat resistant to spoiling for a long time. Heat, on the other hand, drives many things, honey among them, out of their own proper quality. Honey spoils when boiled, but if it stays unheated, it even helps preserve other things from spoiling. The strongest confirmation of this explanation was found in still, marshy waters. In winter, they are no different from other waters to drink, but in summer they turn foul and unwholesome. Since night is thought to correspond to winter, and day to summer, people suppose that water stays more unaltered and unaffected if it is drawn at night. To these fairly plausible arguments, there was added another account, confirmed, as it were, by the plain but reliable experience of sailors. They said they draw the water at night while the river is still settled and quiet, whereas by day, with many people drawing water and sailing about, and many animals stirring through it, it becomes churned up, thick and earthy. And such water is prone to spoil, since all mixed things are more liable to decay than unmixed ones. For mixture produces strife, strife produces change, and putrefaction is itself a kind of change. That is why painters call the mixing of colors corruption, and why the poet used the word stained for dying, while common usage calls what is unmixed and pure incorruptible and undefiled. Earth especially, when mixed with water, alters and spoils its natural drinkable quality. Hence still, hollow waters which fill up with much earth are more prone to spoil, while running waters escape and shake off the earth carried against them. Hesiod did well to praise a spring that is ever-flowing, outflowing, and unmudded. For what is uncorrupted is wholesome, and what is unmixed and pure is uncorrupted. The differences among kinds of soil bear this out no less. Waters running through mountainous, rocky ground are firmer than those of marshy, level ground, since they carry off little earth. The Nile, however, enclosed by soft country, or rather mixed with it as blood is mixed with flesh, enjoys sweetness and is filled with nutrients of a weighty, nourishing power. But it flows along mixed and turbid, and all the more so when it is stirred up, for motion mixes the earthy element into the water. But when it settles, the earthy part sinks down and departs by its own weight. That is why they draw water at night, getting ahead of the sun as well, under whose action the finest and lightest part of the water is always drawn off and lost. When my younger sons had lingered in the theater over some performances and arrived rather late for dinner, Theon's sons jokingly mocked them, calling them dinner delayers and gloom suppers and the like. And they, defending themselves, called the others in turn dinner chasers. One of the older men remarked that it is really the one who is late for dinner who deserves the name Dinner Chaser, since whenever he is running behind, he appears to hurry along faster than a walking pace. He also recalled a witty remark of Galba, Caesar's jester, who used to call those who arrived late to dinner, dinner cravers, since, busy as they were, their love of dining kept them from ever declining an invitation. I remarked that Polycharmus too, when he was a popular leader in Athens and was giving an account of his life before the assembly, said, "These, men of Athens, are my achievements," and added, among other things, "Never, when invited to dinner, did I arrive last." Such a thing is generally thought quite in keeping with democratic manners. Conversely, people forced to wait for latecomers resent them as disagreeable and oligarchic. But Socrates, speaking in defense of the young men, said, "Nor, indeed, is Pittacus said to have been called a gloomsupper by Alcaeus for dining late, but rather, as one who took pleasure, for the most part, in disreputable and worthless drinking companions. But dining too early was once considered disgraceful, and they say that the word for breakfast, akritisma, comes from akrasia, lack of self-control." Theon took this up and said, "Not at all, not if we are to believe those who record the ancient way of life. For they say that the men of old, being industrious and temperate at once, ate bread at dawn dipped in unmixed wine and nothing else. And this, they say, is why that meal was called akritisma, from the unmixed wine akratos, while they called what was prepared for the evening meal opsin, relish, for they dine late, once their business for the day was done." From this, a further question arose about Daipnon dinner, and Ariston, the midday or morning meal, and where each got its name. Ariston seemed to be identical with akritisma. Homer bears witness to this when he speaks of Eumaeus and his companions preparing their Ariston at the appearing of dawn. And it seemed plausible that Ariston was named for the early hour, just as Orion, tomorrow, is. Daipnon, on the other hand, was so named because it gives rest, dianapoi, from toil, since people dine after doing something, or in the middle of doing it. This too can be gathered from Homer, who says, "When the woodcutter got his daipnon ready." Unless, by Zeus, the truth is rather this, that they took their Ariston straight away and without trouble, casually, from whatever was at hand, while their daipnon was already elaborately prepared beforehand, and so they called the one easiest and the other, as it were, the labored one. Our brother Lamprias, who is naturally impudent and fond of a laugh, said he would show that the Roman names for these meals were 1,000 times closer to the Greek originals than the Greek names themselves, so much license being granted to talking nonsense. For he said, the Romans call dinner cena because of its communality, koinonia. The old Romans used to eat their Ariston by themselves, but they dine together with their friends. The midday meal, meanwhile, was called prandium after the hour, since endios means midday, and the rest one takes after Ariston is called endiazine, or else the word signifies some early food or nourishment which they take before they grow faint from hunger. And indeed, he said, to leave aside the bedding, the wine, the honey, the oil, the tasting, the toasting, countless other things plainly use the very same words. Who would not say that komos in Greek becomes komisatio, and that mixing carousi becomes messir, as in Homer, and she in turn mixed honeyed wine in the bowl. That mensa is the table from being set in the middle, and panem is bread as loosening hunger, that the wreath is corona from the head, just as Homer likened the helmet to a stephane, that ketir is carine, to cut, and dense are the teeth, and labra the lips from taking lambanine food through them. Either we must listen to these derivations too without laughing, or else we must not so easily accept those other ones either, cutting words apart and demolishing them piece by piece, like little walls, and slipping through the gaps we make. Sulla's of Carthage, when I arrived in Rome after a long absence, announced a dinner, the hypodecticon, as the Romans call it, and invited, among a few other companions, a pupil of Moderatus the Pythagorean named Lucius, from Tyrrhenia. This man, seeing our Philonous abstaining from living creatures, as was natural, was led on to speak of Pythagoras's teachings, and declared Pythagoras to be Tyrrhenian, not by descent from his father, as some others claim, but himself born, raised, and educated in Tyrrhenia, insisting on this most of all from the symbols, such as not to leave the bedclothes in disorder on rising from bed, not to leave the impression of a pot lifted from the ashes, but to smooth it away. not to receive swallows into the house, not to step over a broom, and not to keep at home any bird with curved talons. For he said that these precepts, though spoken and written by Pythagoreans generally, were actually observed and kept only by the Tyrrhenians. When Lucius had said this, the matter of the swallows above all seemed strange, that a harmless, man-loving creature should be shut out just like the birds of curved talon, which are the most savage and murderous of all. And indeed, the one explanation by which some of the ancients thought to resolve the symbol, as an allusion aimed at slanderous and whispering acquaintances, Lucius himself did not accept. For the swallow has the least share of any bird in whispering, and no more talkativeness or chatter than jays, partridges, or hens. "Is it then," said Sulla's, "because of the myth of the child's murder that they hold swallows in abomination, casting on us from a distance those sufferings out of which, they say, Tereus and the women did and suffered lawless and terrible things, and to this day they call the birds Dalids? And when Gorgias the sophist was fouled by a swallow, he looked up at it and said, 'That is not fine, Philomela. Or is this too an empty notion?' For the nightingale, though implicated in the very same tragic tale, they neither exclude nor banish." "Perhaps," I said, "this too has some sense to it, Sulla's. But consider whether, in the first place, by the very reasoning that excludes the curved talon bird, the swallow too falls into disrepute among them. For it is a flesh eater, and it kills and eats above all the cicadas, sacred and musical creatures that they are. And its flight hugs the ground, as it hunts small, delicate creatures, as Aristotle says. Again, alone among the creatures that share our roof, it lives with us contributing nothing and lodges without paying any due. Yet the stork, though it shares neither shelter nor warmth nor any safety or help from us, still pays some toll for the ground it occupies. It goes about destroying creatures hostile and hateful to man, toads, and snakes. The swallow, by contrast, receives all these benefits from us, and once she has reared her chicks to maturity, departs ungrateful and unheard of again. And here is the strangest thing of all. Alone among the creatures that live in our houses, the fly and the swallow are never tamed to man, nor will they tolerate touch or companionship or any sharing in work or play. The fly out of fear, because it is so often mistreated and driven off, the swallow because she is by nature man-hating and, through her distrust, forever untamed and suspicious. If then, we must view such matters not straightforwardly, but bending them back as it were, look for the reflections of other things within them. Then he who set up the swallow as an example of fickleness and ingratitude does not mean to allow those who attach themselves to us for the occasion and worm their way in to be made close intimates beyond that point, given a share in hearth, home, and our most sacred things. Having said this, I think I gave the conversation license to continue, for I now pressed on boldly and confidently to the other symbols, offering fairly moral interpretations of each. As for the mark left by the pot, Philinus said they wipe it away to teach that one should leave no visible trace of anger behind, but that once it is boiled up and then subsided and settled, all resentment should be wiped clean away. The disturbing of the bedclothes seemed to some to hold no hidden meaning at all, but rather to make plain in itself what is unbecoming, that a place and an impression, like a mold, should be seen left behind by a man who has slept with his wedded wife. Sulla's, however, guessed rather that the symbol was meant to deter sleeping during the day, since the bed is stripped of its readiness for sleep at once, at dawn, implying that one ought to rest at night, and once risen, act by day, and not overlook, so to speak, any trace of a fallen body. For a sleeping man is of no more use than a dead one. In support of this seemed to stand also the Pythagorean precept, enjoining their companions never to lighten anyone's burden, but rather to help load it on and pile it further, as men who allow themselves neither leisure nor ease. Since, while all this was being said, Lucius neither found fault nor praised, but kept silent, listening quietly and looking down at himself, Empedocles, addressing Sulla's by name, said, "Lucius, our friend, if he is troubled by what is being said, then it is time for us to stop as well. But if these matters fall under the rule of silence, still I think that this at least is neither forbidden to say nor unfit to be carried to outsiders, that they abstained above all from fish. This too is recorded of the ancient Pythagoreans, and I myself have met pupils, in our own time, of Alexocrates, who, while otherwise partaking of other things moderately, and indeed even offering sacrifice, by Zeus, nonetheless refuse absolutely to so much as taste fish. The reason Tyndares the Spartan gave for this rule of silence was that it was a special privilege, that fish are called elopes, as having their voice, opa confined and shut in, and that the man who shares my name, bringing his teaching to a Pythagorean close, said, guarding the doctrines within a silent mind, though it be less than they deserve, and that, altogether, these men regarded silence as something divine, since even the gods reveal what they intend to the wise through deeds and facts, without speech. When Lucius replied gently and simply that the true account, perhaps, still remained hidden and unspoken even now, but that there was no begrudging an attempt at what is plausible and likely, Theon the grammarian spoke first, saying that to prove Pythagoras Tyrrhenian would be a great undertaking, and not an easy one. But it is agreed that he spent a long time in the company of the wise men of Egypt, and that he emulated many of their practices, and approved above all those concerning the sacred rites of the priests, among them the matter of beans, since Herodotus says the Egyptians neither sow beans nor eat them, nor can even bear to look at them. And we know that their priests still abstain from fish even now, and in their state of ritual purity they also shun salt, so as to eat no relish, nor anything else mixed with sea salt. Others give various other reasons for this, but there is one true one: hatred of the sea, as something not of our kind, alien to us, or rather altogether hostile by nature to the human element. For they say, the gods are not nourished by the sea, as the Stoics suppose the stars to be. Rather, on the contrary, it was into the sea that the father and savior of their land perished, the one they call the outflow of Osiris. And in mourning for the one born in its left-hand regions and destroyed in its right-hand ones, they hint at the ending of the Nile and its destruction, which occurs in the sea. For this reason, they consider neither its water fit to drink, nor anything it nourishes or produces pure or akin to themselves, since such creatures share with them neither a common air nor a common food. But the very air that preserves and nourishes everything else is deadly to those creatures, as beings that have come into existence and live contrary to nature and need. And one should not be surprised that they consider sea creatures alien and unfit to be mixed into their own blood and breath, seeing that they will not even deign to greet ships' pilots when they meet them, because such men make their living from the sea. Sulla's, approving of this, added, concerning the Pythagoreans, that they for the most part tasted of sacrificial victims only after offering the first portions to the gods, but that no fish is ever fit for sacrifice or offering. I then, once they had finished, said that many people, both philosophers and laymen, would take up arms on Egypt's behalf where the sea is concerned, reckoning up the many benefits it has provided to make our life easier and more pleasant. But the Pythagoreans' truce with fish, on the grounds that they are not of our kind, is strange, indeed rather absurd, or rather altogether savage, a kind of cyclopean privilege granted to other creatures over kinship and intimacy, while they themselves are cooked and consumed at our hands. And yet they say that Pythagoras once bought up a catch of fish, and then ordered the net let go, not as one indifferent to the fish as foreign and hostile, but as one paying ransom for captives who had become his friends and kin. It is for this reason, I said, that the fairness and gentleness of these men suggests we should suspect quite the opposite, that perhaps it was for the sake of practicing justice, and habituating themselves to it, that they especially spared sea creatures. Since these, unlike other creatures, give men no pretext at all, however slight, for ill treatment, as fish do us no wrong, nor are they even capable of doing so. One may infer, both from their sayings and from their sacred rites, that the men of old considered it an accursed and unlawful act not merely to eat, but even to kill, any creature that does no harm. But hemmed in by sheer numbers pressing upon them, and they say, urged on by some oracle from Delphi bidding them defend their crops as these were being destroyed, they began to sacrifice animals, yet still troubled and afraid as they did so, they called the act erding and resine, to perform, as though doing something momentous in sacrificing a living creature. And even now they keep strict watch against slaughtering a victim before it has nodded in assent under the libation poured over it. So scrupulous were they with regard to every kind of wrongdoing, and yet, to leave everything else aside, if people had abstained only from hens or hares, it would not have been long before, through sheer numbers, it became impossible either to inhabit a city or to enjoy the fruits of the earth. So that, necessity pressing them at first, it soon became, through pleasure, an easy matter to put an end to abstaining from meat altogether. But the race of sea creatures neither consumes the same air as we do, nor the same water, nor encroaches on our crops, but is contained as it were within another world of its own, keeping to its own boundaries. And death stands as the penalty over those who cross them, so that it gives the belly no pretext, small or great, against them. Rather, the hunting and netting of every kind of fish is plainly the work of gluttony and a love of delicacies, disturbing the seas for no just cause and plunging down into the depths. For surely no one calls the red mullet a ravager of fields, nor the parrotfish a grape-eater, nor calls any mullet or bass a seed-gatherer, as we name land creatures in accusation. Nor could one charge the largest fish with anything of what we pettily hold against the weasel or the household fly. And so, restraining themselves not by law alone from wronging man, but also by nature from wronging anything that does no harm, they made least use of fish among their relishes, or none at all. For even apart from the question of injustice, the whole business surrounding fish seems to display a kind of intemperance and gluttony, being extravagant and overly elaborate. This is why Homer represents not only the Greeks abstaining from fish while encamped beside the Hellespont, but sets no seafood before the luxury-loving Phaeacians either, nor before the dissolute suitors, though both peoples are islanders. And the companions of Odysseus, sailing over so vast a sea, nowhere let down hook, or line, or net, so long as barley meal remained. But when the ship's provisions had run out, shortly before they laid hands on the cattle of the sun, they took to catching fish, making it not a relish but a necessary food, with bent hooks and hunger gnawed at their bellies. Driven by that same necessity, both to eat fish and to devour the cattle of the sun. This is why abstinence from fish has become, not only among the Egyptians or the Syrians, but among the Greeks as well, a part of ritual purity, warding off, I think, along with what is just also the excess and extravagance of such eating. Nestor then took up the argument. As for my own fellow citizens, they get no credit at all, just like the Megareans. And yet you have often heard me say that the priests of Poseidon, whom we call Hieromnemones, never eat fish, for the god is called Phytalmios, the nurturer. The descendants of Helen, the ancient also sacrificed to Poseidon as ancestral god, holding that man was born from the moist element, as the Syrians likewise believe. And that is why they too revere the fish, as a kinsman and foster brother, philosophizing rather more reasonably than Anaximander. For Anaximander does not declare that fish and men came into being among the same beings, but that men were first generated within fish, and were nourished there like dogfish, and when they became capable of helping themselves, then came forth and took to dry land. So then, just as fire consumes the wood from which it was kindled, though that wood was, so to speak, its mother and father, so too, as the poet who inserted the marriage of Ceyx into the works of Hesiod, put it, Anaximander, having declared the fish to be the common father and mother of mankind, thereby discredited it as food. Philo, the physician, insisted that the disease called elephantiasis had become known only quite recently, since none of the ancient physicians had made any mention of this affliction, being occupied instead with other, minor and obscure conditions difficult for most people to observe. I myself, for my part, produced as a witness on his behalf Athenodorus the philosopher, who records in the first book of his Epidemics that it was only in the time of Asclepiades that not only elephantiasis, but also hydrophobia first came to light. Those present were astonished that new diseases should then, for the first time, have had their origin and formation in nature, but they thought it no less astonishing that such considerable symptoms could have escaped notice for so long a time. Most of them, however, inclined rather toward the second view, as being the more plausible for human nature, holding that nature is least of all, in matters of this kind, fond of novelty, and no eager artisan of new conditions in the body, any more than in a city. Diogenes then said that the diseases and affections of the soul, too, follow a certain common and ancestral path. And yet, he said. Vice is manifold and adventurous of every sort, and the soul is self-governing and master of itself, able, if it wishes, to change and turn easily. Still, its very disorder has a certain order, and it keeps due measure even in its passions, as the sea does in its overflowings, and no form of wickedness has broken out that was unrecorded even among the ancients. Rather, there are many varieties of desire, countless movements and shapes of fear, and the forms of grief and pleasure are a task too great to enumerate exhaustively. None of this is a thing of today or yesterday, but it has always existed, and no one knows from where it first appeared. How then could a new disease or a late-born affection come to the body, when the body, unlike the soul, which has within itself its own source of motion, is instead bound up with causes shared in common with the rest of nature, and mixed into a compound whose very indeterminacy wanders within fixed limits, like a ship tossing about within a confined course? For the constitution of disease is not without cause, so as to introduce, contrary to all order, a coming into being and a power out of nothing, and it is no easy task to discover a genuinely new cause, one that did not simply declare that unprecedented air, or strange water, or untasted foods, now for the first time flowing in here from certain other worlds or spaces between worlds, are the reason. For it is from these very things, the things by which we also live, that we fall ill. There are no seeds of disease that belong to disease alone. Rather, it is the vices of these things in relation to us, and our own errors regarding them, that disturb nature, and these disturbances have everlasting varieties, though they are often called by new names. For names belong to convention, but the affections themselves belong to nature. Hence it is that, being variously colored within these fixed bounds, they have produced the illusion of novelty. Just as it is possible for a sudden barbarism or solecism to arise in the parts of speech and in their combinations with one another, so too the mixtures of the body have fixed kinds of slips and transgressions, belonging in a sense to nature itself, even among the things that are contrary to nature. In this respect, the mythographers, too, are clever. They say that altogether monstrous and prodigious animals came into being at the time of the Battle of the Giants, when the moon was deviating from its course and not making its risings from its accustomed point. In just the same way, some people think it fitting that nature gives birth to new diseases as if they were portents, fabricating for the change a cause that is neither plausible nor implausible, but simply pointing to the excess and the greater degree of certain affections as constituting their novelty and difference. This is not correct, my dear Philo. Intensification and increase add magnitude or quantity, but they do not remove the underlying thing from its own kind. Just so, I think, elephantiasis is not some intensified form of one of the scaly, mangy conditions, nor is hydrophobia one of the disorders of the stomach or of melancholy. And yet this, surely, is remarkable, that not even Homer was ignorant of it, unbeknownst to you, for by the raging dog, he is clearly referring to this very affliction, from which men, too, are said to rage or go mad. When Diogenes had gone through these points, Philo himself replied with a measured response to his argument and urged me to join him in speaking on behalf of the ancient physicians, on the ground that they would be liable to a charge of neglect or of ignorance in the gravest matters, if indeed these diseases do not turn out to be more recent than their own era. In the first place, then, it seemed to us that Diogenes was not right to insist that intensifications and relaxations make no difference and do not remove a thing from its kind. For on that reasoning, we would have to say that vinegar does not differ from sour wine, nor bitterness from astringency, nor darnel among the wheat from mint among the sweet herbs. And yet these are plainly departures and changes of quality, the relaxations being cases of things withering away, the intensifications cases of things growing more vehement. Or else we would have to say that there is no difference between the flame of a thin vapor and the mere glow of a flame, nor between the hoarfrost of dew and the hail of a rainstorm, but that all these are simply intensifications and vehemences of the same thing. And it would then be time to say that blindness differs not at all from dimness of sight, nor cholera from mere nausea, but only by degree, by more and less. Yet none of this is reasonable. For if they grant that what has now come about is simply the acceptance of an intensification and a vehemence, then in the first place, since the novelty consists in quantity and not in quality, the paradox remains just the same. And secondly, as Sophocles said, not badly, about things disbelieved because they did not exist before, when the question is whether they have now come into being. All things uncreated came first, once for all. It seems reasonable, too, that the affections did not all run out toward their coming into being at once, in a single dash, as if a single starting gate had fallen, but that, one following upon another in constant succession, each received its first origin at some particular time. One might conjecture, I said, that those conditions arising from deficiency, and whatever is produced by an onset of heat or cold, were the first to appear in human bodies. But that surfeit, luxury, and self-indulgence came upon men later, the result of idleness and leisure amid an abundance of necessities that produced a great deal of harmful residue. Residue in which the varied forms of disease, and every manner of their combination and mixture with one another, are constantly producing something new. For what accords with nature is ordered and well defined, since nature is order or the product of order. But disorder, like the sand of Pindar, escapes number, and whatever is contrary to nature is at once indeterminate and unlimited. Things admit of being true only in a single, simple way, but of being false in countless ways. Rhythms and harmonies, too, have their fixed rules, yet the ways in which men go wrong in lyre playing, song, and dance could not be encompassed by anyone. Indeed, Phrynichus, the tragic poet, says of himself, "Dance gave me as many figures as the waves the deadly night of winter raises on the sea." And Chrysippus says that the combinations arising from only 10 simple propositions exceed 1,000,000 in number. But this was refuted by Hipparchus, who demonstrated that the affirmative form contains 100,000 and 1,049 compound combinations, and the negative form of it 310,952. Xenocrates, for his part, declared that the number of syllables which the letters produce in combination with one another amounts to 20 times 10,000 times 10,000. What wonder is it then if the body, possessing within itself so many powers, and constantly taking on so many qualities introduced through food and drink, and employing motions and changes that keep neither a single fixed occasion nor always the same order should, through the combinations of all these things with one another, sometimes produce diseases that are new and unfamiliar. This is just as Thucydides records the plague at Athens to have occurred, inferring its lack of precedent chiefly from the fact that the flesh-eating animals would not touch the corpses. So too those who fell ill around the Red Sea, as Agatharchides has recorded, experienced other symptoms both new and unrecorded. Little snake-like worms that ate through their shins and popped out from their arms, and which, when touched, would retreat back in again, and produced unbearable inflammations as they coiled themselves within the muscles. This affliction, like many others, is known to have occurred neither before nor since to anyone but those people alone. Indeed, a certain man suffering from difficulty urinating, over a long period, passed a stalk of barley straw complete with joints. And we know of our own guest friend Ephebus at Athens expelling, together with a great quantity of seed, a small hairy creature that moved swiftly on many feet. Aristotle records that Timon's tortoise in Cilicia hibernated for 2 months of every year, showing no sign at all that it was alive except by breathing alone. And indeed, in the records of Menon's school, it is written down as a sign of a liver ailment that domestic mice would be carefully watched and chased, a thing which is nowhere seen to happen now. We ought not, then, to be astonished if something occurs that did not exist before, nor if something that did exist before has since disappeared. For the cause lies in the nature of bodies, which takes on different compositions at different times. As for introducing new air or strange water as a cause, let us set that aside, if Diogenes does not wish it. Though we do know that the followers of Democritus both say and write that, when worlds outside our own parish and bodies of a foreign kind flow in from the effluence, the beginnings of plagues and unfamiliar afflictions often intrude here as a result. Let us also set aside the local devastations among us caused by earthquakes, droughts and rainstorms, by which the winds and the springs, having an earth-born nature, are necessarily affected along with the earth and change along with it. But as for the change that has occurred with respect to food, delicacies, and other habits of diet on the body, this must not be passed over. Many things once untasted and inedible have now become most pleasant, such as wine mixed with honey and the womb of animals. And they say that the ancients did not even eat bran, which is why Homer says, "I value him no more than a fig," speaking in this way of bran, referring to the practice of throwing it away and discarding it in disgust. And we know that many of our older contemporaries are still unable to taste ripe cucumber, the median apple, citron, or pepper. From such things, then, it is reasonable that bodies should experience strange effects and shift gradually in their compositions, producing their own peculiar quality and residue. And further, that the order and rearrangement of foods should make no small difference. For what are called cold tables of oysters, sea urchins, raw vegetables, once occupied, as Plato says of light things, the position from tail to mouth, now, having been transferred, they occupy the first place instead of the last. A great matter, too, is that of what are called appetizers taken before drinking. The ancients did not even drink water before eating something solid, whereas people nowadays, fasting and already half drunk, take hold of their food with a body already soaked through and seething, offering thin, sharp, and pungent things as kindling for the appetite, and then gorging themselves on the rest in that condition. And nothing is weaker in the face of change, or more productive of the origin of new diseases, than the great susceptibility of the flesh to what happens at the baths, just as iron is softened and made to flow by fire, and then receives its tempering and hardening from cold water. There flow into Acheron the pyriphlegethon. This, I think, is what one of those who lived not long before us might have said, on the opening of a bathhouse door. For those men of old used such loose and soft habits that King Alexander himself once slept in the bathhouse while running a fever, and the wives of the Gauls used to bring pots of porridge into the baths and eat together with their children while bathing at the same time. But nowadays the baths seem to rage like mad dogs, barking and tearing at us. The air drawn in within them, having become a mixture of moisture and fire, allows no part of the body to remain at rest, but shakes and disturbs every particle of it and dislodges it from its place, until we quench ourselves, all fevered and boiling. There is, then, no need, I said, my dear Diogenianus, for the argument to resort to extraneous or otherworldly causes. The change in diet itself is quite capable, on its own, of both generating some diseases and making others disappear. While reading Aristotle's Physical Problems on our journey to Thermopylae, Florus himself, as philosophical natures are generally prone to do, became filled with many perplexities and passed them on to his companions, bearing witness to Aristotle's own statement that wide learning creates many starting points for perplexity. Now the rest of these questions provided us with a not ungraceful pastime during the day in our walks, but the matter said about dreams, that they are unreliable and false, especially during the leaf-shedding months, came up again after dinner, I am not sure how, when Favorinus had taken up other subjects for discussion. To your companions, then, who are my sons? It seemed that Aristotle had resolved the difficulty, and they thought there was no need to inquire or say anything more than, like him, to blame the fruits of the season. For being still young and full of vigor, they generate a great deal of turbulent breath within the body. For it is not likely that wine alone ferments and grows agitated, nor that oil, when newly pressed, makes a crackling noise in lamps, as the heat throws off vapor in waves. Rather, we see that fresh grain, too, and all the season's fruit, are swollen and distended until they breathe off what is gaseous and unconcocted. And as evidence that some foods are conducive to bad dreams and disturbing to the visions seen in sleep, they used as testimony both beans and the head of the octopus, which those who wish to practice divination through dreams are told to avoid. Favorinus himself, though in most respects an utterly devoted admirer of Aristotle, and one who assigns the peripatetic school the largest share of plausibility, on that occasion nonetheless offered some argument. Of Democritus, an old argument that he brought out, as it were, from smoke and dimness, and set about clearing and brightening. he put forward this very homely doctrine that Democritus states. Images sink deep into bodies through the pores and produce the visions that occur in sleep as they are carried back up. And these images travel about, coming off from everything, from utensils and clothes and plants, but especially from living creatures. Because of much agitation and heat, not only bearing shapes and impressions molded from the body, as Epicurus supposes, following Democritus up to this point, but then abandoning the argument, but also gathering up and drawing along with them, from each source, impressions of the movements and deliberations of the soul, and of characters and passions. And when they strike upon us, they speak and report, as if alive to those who receive them, the opinions, reasonings, and impulses of those who sent them out, whenever they approach while keeping their images distinct and unconfused. This happens above all when their passage occurs through smooth air, unimpeded and swift. But the autumn air, in which the trees shed their leaves, has much unevenness and roughness, and it distorts and deflects the images in many directions, and makes their clarity faint and weak through the slowness of their passage as it grows dim. Just as, conversely, images that leap forth quickly and are carried swiftly from things that are seething and burning hot render their impressions fresh and significant. Then, looking over at Autobulus and his companions with a smile, he said, "But I see that you are already able to fight shadows against these images, and to think you are accomplishing something by applying touch to an old opinion as if to a painting." And Autobulus said, "Stop your embroidering at us. We are not unaware that, wishing to make Aristotle's opinion prevail, you have set up Democritus's opinion as a mere shadow beside it. So we shall turn to that opinion and do battle with it, since it accuses the new fruits and the dear autumn produce unjustly. For summer bears them witness, and so does the late season, when the autumn fruit is most green and bursting with sap, as Antimachus said. For those of us who eat it fresh, just as it is produced, are less troubled by deceptive and false dreams. But the leaf-shedding months, already encamping alongside winter, keep their foods in digestion, and what remains of the tree fruits is shriveled and wrinkled, having let go of that sharp, maddening quality entirely. Moreover, those who drink new wine at the earliest opportunity drink it in the month of Anthesterion, after winter. And that day we call the day of the good spirit, while the Athenians call it the jar opening. We see even the workers, fearful, always drawing off the must while it is still fermenting. So let us abandon this slandering of the gods' gifts and take another road, the one that the very name of the season points to, along with the airy and false dreams. For it is called leaf-shedding, on account of the coldness and dryness that then causes the leaves to fall away, except for whatever is warm or oily, such as olive, laurel, and palm, or moist, such as myrtle and ivy. For in these plants the blending of qualities helps them, but not in the others. For the sticky, cohesive quality does not remain, either because the moisture is thickened by cold or dried up through deficiency or weakness. Now it is possible for plants too to flourish and grow through moisture or warmth, but this is truer still of animals, and conversely, cold and dryness are destructive. That is why Homer charmingly used to call mortals the moist ones and called rejoicing being warmed, while he called what is painful and fearful chilling and shivering. The words bloodless and skeleton are applied to corpses, the name itself reproaching their dryness. Further, blood, which has the most sovereign power within us, is at once both warm and moist, while old age lacks both qualities. And as the year runs its course, autumn seems to be, as it were, its old age. For the moist has not yet arrived, and the warm is no longer strong. And this condition, being plainly one of dryness together with coldness, renders bodies vulnerable to diseases. It is inevitable that souls share the condition of bodies, and especially that, when the breath grows chilled and thickened, the power of divination is dimmed, like a mirror clouded over with mist. It therefore yields nothing clear or articulate or well-defined in its visions, so long as it remains thick, unlit, and contracted. This is the ninth book of the Table Talk, Dear Saucius Senecio. It contains the discussions that took place at Athens in the museum, and especially it is fitting that the number 9 should belong to the Muses. As for the number, if it exceeds the customary 10 questions, that should not cause surprise. For it was right to render to the Muses everything belonging to the Muses in full, and to take nothing away, as though from sacred things, since we owe them more and finer offerings than these. Ammonius, while serving as strategos at Athens, held an examination in the Diognian of those who were learning letters, geometry, rhetoric, and music, and he invited to dinner those teachers whose pupils had distinguished themselves. Many of the other scholars were present too, and pretty much all of our usual circle. Now Achilles invited to dinner only those among the combatants who had actually fought in single combat, wishing, as they say, that if any anger or harshness had arisen between men under arms, they might lay it aside and set it down once they had shared a common feast and table. But with Ammonius, the opposite happened, for the rivalry and contentiousness of the teachers, once they had gotten into their cups, grew still more intense, and by now there were propositions and challenges flying about, undisciplined and disorderly. So first, he ordered Aratin to sing to the lyre, and when he had sung the opening lines of the works, so after all there was not just one kind of strife, he praised him for having fitted the words so suitably to the occasion. Then he raised the subject of the timeliness of verses, how it sometimes has not only charm, but also great usefulness. And the rhapsode's case was immediately on everyone's lips, at the wedding of Ptolemy, who was marrying his sister, an act considered strange and unlawful. The rhapsode had begun with those very lines, and Zeus called Hera his sister and his wife. And there was the one at the court of King Demetrius who was reluctant to sing after dinner, so the king sent to him his son, still a small boy, Philip, and the singer immediately took up the boy and sang, "To rear this child of mine worthy of Heracles and of us." And Anaxarchus, when he was being pelted with apples by Alexander at dinner, rose up and said, "Some god shall be struck by a mortal hand." But best of all was the Corinthian boy taken captive when the city was destroyed. Mummius, going carefully among the freeborn children who knew their letters, ordered one to write a verse, and the boy wrote, "Thrice blessed, four times blessed, the Danaans who perished then." They say Mummius was moved and wept and set free all those connected with the boy. He also recalled the story of the wife of Theodorus, the tragic actor, who would not receive him into her bed while the contest was still close at hand. But when he had won and come into her, she embraced him and said, "Son of Agamemnon, now that is permitted to you." After this, several of those present were moved to bring up many untimely remarks as well, on the ground that it is not without use to know and guard against them. For instance, they say that when Pompey the Great, on returning from his great campaign, was present as his daughter's tutor gave a demonstration, and a book was handed to her, the girl happened upon this very opening, "You have come from war, would that you had perished there." And when an unattributed rumor reached Cassius Longinus that his son had died abroad, and no one could say whether it was true or dispel the suspicion, a senator, already an older man, came in to him and said, "Will you not disdain, Longinus, an untrustworthy rumor and malicious talk, as though you did not know and had not read the line, 'Rumor never wholly perishes'?" And the man at Rhodes, when a grammarian asked him for a line to use as a demonstration in the theater, held out to him, "Get off the island quickly, most contemptible of the living," it being unclear whether he meant it as a joke or missed the mark unintentionally. This, at any rate, wittily soothed the uproar. Since it was customary at the museum gatherings for lots to be passed around and for those paired together to propose learned questions to one another, Ammonius, fearing that some of the men in the same profession might be paired together, ordered, without drawing lots, that the geometer should put a question to the grammarian, and the musician to the rhetorician, and then that the returns should be reversed in the opposite order. So Hermias the geometer put first to Protogenes the grammarian the question of stating the reason why the letter alpha is placed first among all the letters. Protogenes gave the answer commonly stated in the schools, that the vowels rightly take precedence over the consonants and semi-vowels, and among the vowels, since some are long, some short, and some, called of two times, are both, these naturally differ in power. And among these same vowels again, the one holding the most commanding rank is the one fit to be placed before the other two, and subordinate to neither, such as alpha. For this letter is willing neither to be ranked second to iota nor to upsilon, and to be combined with either so as to form a single syllable out of the two, nor to share their condition. But as though indignant, it springs away and always seeks a beginning of its own. Whereas whichever of those two you please when placed first can be used together with the other that follows and harmonizes with it, and can form the syllables of words, as in tomorrow. To play the flute, Ajax, to feel shame, and countless others. Therefore, like athletes in the pentathlon, it surpasses and wins by 3 points. In most cases by being a vowel, and further, among vowels, by being one of two times, and further still by these same qualities naturally fitting it to lead and never to come second or to follow. When Protogenes had finished, Ammonius called on me and said, "You are no help at all to Cadmus, you Boeotian, whom they say placed Alpha first of all because the Phoenicians so name the ox, which they place not second or third, as Hesiod does, but first among necessities." "Not at all," I said, "for I am more bound to help my own grandfather, if I can, than the grandfather of Dionysus. For Lamprias, my grandfather, used to say that the first sound naturally produced among articulate sounds is emitted through the power of Alpha. For the breath in the mouth is shaped chiefly by the movements of the lips, and when these first open, with the upper part parting, this sound comes out. One that is quite simple and requires no effort at all, calling for no engagement or restraint of the tongue, but is sent out with the tongue lying in its place. Which is also why infants utter this as their very first sound." And he said that the verb to hear, ayin, was likewise named from the perception of sound, and many similar words, such as to sing, aiding, to play the flute, allin, and to raise a cry, alalazine. And I think that to lift, aaron, and to open, anoigine too, were not inappropriately named from the opening and raising of the lips, by which this sound issues from the mouth. That is also why the names of the consonant letters, with one exception, all make use of alpha, as if it were a light for the blindness that otherwise surrounds them. Only the letter pi lacks this feature, for phi and chi are respectively pi and kappa aspirated. In response to this, Hermias said he accepted both accounts, and I said, "Why then did you not also explain to us whether there is any reason for the number of the letters, as it seems to me there is? I take as evidence the fact that the total of the consonants and semivowels, in relation to one another and to the vowels, did not come about by chance, but according to the first proportion, as we call it. For there being 9, and 8, and 7, the middle number both exceeds and is exceeded in the same ratio. And of the outer terms, the greatest bears the same ratio to the smallest as the number of the muses bears to that of Apollo. For the group of 9 belongs, of course, to the muses, and the group of 7 has been allotted to the leader of the muses. And when these two are added together, they naturally double the middle number, since the semivowels too share in a way in the power of both." And Hermias said, "Hermes is said to have been the first of the gods in Egypt to discover letters. That is also why the Egyptians draw the ibis first among their letters, as belonging properly to Hermes. Not rightly, in my own opinion, since they thus grant precedence in matters of letters to a mute, voiceless creature. To Hermes above all the number 4 is assigned, and many record that the god was born on the 4th day of the waxing month. Indeed the first, so-called Phoenician letters named for Cadmus, numbered 4 times 4 as the group of 4 supplied them. And of the letters discovered later, Palamedes first added 4, and Simonides afterward added just as many more. Moreover, that among all numbers the first perfect one is the triad, as having a beginning, middle, and end, and the hexad, as being equal to the sum of its own parts. This is clear. Of these, then, the hexad multiplied by the tetrad, and the triad multiplied by the ogdoad, the first perfect number of the first cube, has furnished the sum of 24. While he was still speaking, Zepyrian the schoolmaster was visibly laughing and muttering asides. And when Hermias finished, he could not restrain himself but called such things sheer nonsense. For the number of the letters, he said, had come to be so great, and their order arranged as it is, by no reason principle, but by a kind of coincidence, just as, he said, the first line of the Iliad happens to have the same number of syllables as the first line of the Odyssey. And again the last line matches the last, purely by chance and automatically. After this we restrained Hermias, who wanted to put some question to Zepyrian. But Maximus the rhetorician, from farther off, asked him, out of Homer, which hand of Aphrodite Diomes wounded. When Zepyrian quickly countered by asking in which leg Philip was lame, Maximus said, "It is not the same thing, for Demosthenes has given no explanation on that point, But you, if you admit you are at a loss, others will show where the poet indicates the wounded hand to those with sense. So we thought Zipirion had been thoroughly refuted, and since he kept silent, we asked Maximus to demonstrate. First then, Maximus said, since the verses run thus. Then, reaching out, the son of great-hearted Tydeus wounded the tip of her hand, leaping forward with his sharp spear. It is clear that, since he wished to strike the left hand, he had no need to leap across, because he was already facing her right hand with his own left as they approached from opposite sides. For it was reasonable that the stronger hand, especially as Aeneas was being carried off, should be the one holding him back, and that other hand wound her, and let the wounded goddess be carried up into heaven, while Athena laughed and said, surely some daughter of Achaea has been inciting the women of Troy again, whom she now loves exceedingly, to go along with the Trojans. Caressing one of the deep-bosomed Achaean women, she has scratched her delicate hand against a golden brooch. I think that you too, best of teachers, he said, whenever you affectionately stroke and caress one of your pupils, ought not to do this with the left hand but with the right, just as it is fitting that Aphrodite too, being the most dexterous of the goddesses, shows affection to the heroines in this way. This made everyone else more cheerful, but Sospes the rhetorician, noticing that the grammarian Hylas alone was silent and sullen, for he had not fared very well in the recitations, cried out to him, raising his voice, such alone was the soul of Telamonian Ajax, and went on addressing the rest of the line even more loudly to him. But come here, Lord, that you may hear our word and speech. Tame your might and your unyielding spirit. Hylas, still uneven-tempered from his irritation, answered rudely that the soul of Ajax, having drawn the 20th lot in Hades, had according to Plato exchanged its nature for that of a lion, whereas he himself often felt it would be better to become the donkey of the comic old man than to see men inferior to himself living more conspicuously than he. Sospes laughed and said, well then, while we are about to put on the pack saddle, if you care at all for Plato, teach us by what reasoning he has made the soul of the son of Telamon proceed by lot to the 20th choice. Hylas, thinking he was being mocked, waved this off in disgust, and being out of sorts, our brother took up the question and said, well then, does not Ajax always rank second in beauty, stature, and courage, after the blameless son of Peleus? And 20 is the second decade, and the decade is the strongest among numbers, just as Achilles is among the Achaeans. When we laughed, Ammonius said, let these remarks of yours, Lamprias, stand as jests aimed at Hylas. But for us, not in jest but in earnest, since you have willingly taken up the argument, go through the reason. So Lamprias, taken aback, then after pausing not long, said that in many places Plato plays with us through the use of names. But wherever he mixes some myth with his discourse about the soul, he there makes the fullest use of intelligence. For just as he calls the intelligible nature of heaven a winged chariot because of the harmonious revolution of the cosmos, so here he names the messenger of the dead, of Pamphylian stock, son of Harmonius, and calls him hinting that souls are born according to harmony and are fitted together with bodies, and when released they are born together from every side into the air, and from there they turn again to their second births. What then prevents us from taking the word, 20th, as spoken not with reference to the truth, but as likely, icos and fashioned for the sake of the argument, or with reference to the lot, as meaning at random, ike, and happening by chance? For he always touches on the three causes, being indeed the first to do so, or rather the one who best understood how what is according to fate is naturally intertwined and interwoven with what is according to chance, and again, what is in our own power with each of these and with both together.